This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we visit with news director Dave Thompson, and we have our weekly movie review with Matt Olean. But we are going to start today with a preview of the upcoming episode of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, airing this Sunday at 4 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Central. Joining me now is the host of the show, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, UND Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Always happy to be here, Ashley.
The theme of this one is peace. And you start out talking with your guest, longtime pacifist and activist Kathy Kelly, a founding member of Voices in the Wilderness, someone who's been arrested more than 60 times in various activism sorts of efforts, and you start out talking about the fact that peace is very hard to define. Why?
Well, so anytime you ask, you know, or anytime you think about what a peaceful world might look like, it's no war, it's no brutality, it's no violence. But we don't have images of peace is when you can all build barns together, or peace is when you sit next to a bunny rabbit and, and, you know, don't eat them, right? I mean, you know, those are silly examples, but that's the level of lack of sophistication that we're at when we want to talk about peace as a topic in and of itself.
It's always peace, a lack of something else.
That's absolutely right. And so, and also it's always sort of deferred to other things. Peace is nonviolence. Peace is lack of injustice. Peace is coexistence. And we don't have any sense of what that means. And so as a philosopher who's interested in defining things, and as a radio person who wants to talk about the substance, I didn't have a lot to grab onto. I didn't have a really strong starting place. And so I started off just by asking her, how do you deal with that? And her response was often to talk about stories and experiences. And over the course of the episode, you begin to develop a picture of what peace looks like by the way she has pursued it in her lifetime. And it's super compelling and super interesting.
It comes off to me anyway as a state of mind.
Well, that certainly is one of the places where we end up at is, you know, As I mentioned in the show, the Greeks used to talk about justice as a character trait, that a person was a just person, and we've left that beside. And she tends to talk about peace in that same way, that a person is a peaceful person, and if they are peaceful, their actions will be peaceful, and their relationships will be peaceful, and they will promote peace. And again, that makes a certain amount of sense, because if you think about what it's like to feel peaceful, you are not surrounded by aggressive people. You are not surrounded by people you don't trust. You are surrounded by people who you feel comfortable with and who you can share that peace with, and you feed off of one another. So peace is very much about relationships and finding a place that is separate from the aggression and the violence and the war and the torture and the abuse that we see every day.
In as much as peace is the absence of all these things that you mentioned, is it also a little like this, you know, Sherlock Moriarty sort of complex? You don't need someone like Sherlock if you don't have a supreme villain like Moriarty. Is there peace without violence?
I think there is. We might not necessarily know that it's called that. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. when we're kids and we're playing in the street and we're not yet told to be afraid of strangers, or when we are in a relationship with someone and we're lying in bed, we don't think necessarily, oh, this is so much better than my last relationship, or, oh my God, I'm so happy that I'm naive and I don't know that there's someone out to get me, right? We're just, we're in the moment. And that's part of what makes talking about peace so difficult, is being at peace is being in the moment. It's being mindful. It's being present and in the world that you're living in. And that is a paradox for a philosopher, because of course a philosopher wants to step back and reflect, but if you're stepping back and reflecting, you're not necessarily being in the moment. And so that also makes it harder to talk about peace.
Right. It's the riddle, what has seven letters and disappears as soon as you say its name? Silence.
Well, there you go. That's excellent. Yes, that's exactly right. The philosophers call it the problem of self-reference. There's a lot of things that you can't use it to talk about themselves. And the moment you invoke that process, you're already walking away from what you're trying to do. And peace appears to be that in some level.
Why did you want to have Kathy Kelly on to discuss this topic?
I have found there to be an incredible lack of sophisticated conversations about peace, in part because it has become so political in our society. I think that in other cultures and in other traditions of philosophy, there's a lot more conversation about peace. Buddhism, for example, is a very long discussion of what peace means. We tend to talk about just war theory. We tend to talk about just punishment, retribution, things like that. And now in our contemporary society, peace is the hippie dream of the lefty, right? That the right-wing conservative, the Republican, understands that this is a world of war and we have to support our troops and we have to build bigger bombs and we have to build faster planes. And that also runs at odds with the Christian worldview that lots of people on the right claim to be affiliated with. Christianity is a religion of peace. In fact, all religions are basically religions of peace. And Jesus put forth theories of what peace and love and understanding and turning the other cheek would look like. But that's not part of our politics anymore. The moment you have someone, a major candidate, who starts talking about peace or talking about those sorts of things, they get laughed off of the stage. Mm-hmm. And so it was important to me to have a conversation to say, look, we can have a sophisticated discussion about peace. We can take it seriously as a topic and show how, whether on the right or whether on the left, whether a Democrat or Republican, a libertarian, a socialist, a centrist, whatever – you can invoke the ideas of peace to make a better world. It's not childish to want to pursue peace. That was my goal for the conversation.
Am I oversimplifying or just simply coming from a place of lack of knowledge about Far Eastern religions in saying, though, that a lot of times there is this duality? You know, you mentioned Buddhism and even in parts of Hinduism, which came from a yogic lifestyle, it's founded on peace and nonviolence, but there's also honor in being a warrior.
What gets called the martial virtues, the excellences of human behavior that come from war and conflict, permeate all cultures. And this idea that to be a man, you have to have fought in war, that it's a coming of age experience. This also is very common in, I don't want to say all cultures because I don't know all cultures, but right, certainly most cultures that we know of, this is very common. So there is this idea that to really fully realize your humanity, you have to face war and conflict and violence. And I don't necessarily think that's true. And there's a very famous essay that I love called The Moral Equivalent of War that starts off by basically saying those who think that war is inevitable suffer from a lack of imagination. Right? And William James, who wrote the essay, argues that you can get those same virtues by having people build bridges together, having people go through the forest and hike and engage in community service, the collective virtues, the steadfastness, the strength, the skills, the survival, all that kind of stuff that we get from war can be used in peaceful means. Now, we didn't have that conversation in the Why Radio episode,
right,
but I have always found that to be very, very powerful. So to get back to your earlier comment, every religion that tries to give a picture of what the real world is has to allow for value in war, because war is part of the human condition. But it doesn't mean that it is inevitable or that we can't overcome war. And that's ultimately the goal. Not to mention, there's a huge difference between world wars and skirmishes. There's a huge difference between drone warfare and tension between two islands or countries or something like that. We have tended to reduce our notion of war into a binary. There's either war or there's not, but there are better and worse wars. You know, that's why we have the Geneva Convention. That's why we outlawed gas warfare. That's why there are certain things that quote unquote civilized countries don't do in the theater of war, because it's not just war or not war, but there's kinds of wars and ways to engage in conflicts that are healthier than others. And again, I'll use that relationship metaphor. Anyone who's been in a long-term relationship knows that no matter how you get, how angry you get with your partner, there are things that you don't say because there are things that – you're right. I mean, there are healthy ways to fight and unhealthy ways to fight, and the relationships that last are the ones that argue – healthily. Mm-hmm. And so the countries that want to coexist and flourish need to have healthy conflict rather than unhealthy conflict.
And sometimes in that marriage, you need to just say, I'm sorry for what I said when I was angry, right?
That's right. And sometimes you have to apologize for something when you don't think you're wrong, mm-hmm. because it's a sign of love and affection to say, look, I'm sorry. You know, I acquiesce because you're important to me, and I don't lose face by apologizing. Yeah. I don't lose face by showing love. And that's something
you
that
lose votes.
You know, that's something that we've lost the sense of, right? Especially in the last 6 or 7 years, that apologizing is okay. That accepting gracefully that you lose is okay. It doesn't make you less of a person, less of a man, less of an American. It makes you healthier and happier and more relaxed and gives you better relationships. And so then again, on the grand scale, a country that doesn't want to engage in war, a country that doesn't constantly look for conflict, is richer, healthier, more just, and its people aren't as angry.
We're visiting with Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the host of Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. This Sunday's episode airs at 4 o'clock Mountain, 5 p.m. Central. His guest is Kathy Kelly. She is one of the founding members of Voices in the Wilderness. She is a longtime peace activist, and that is, of course, the theme of this episode. Jack, in the span of human history, there has always been that I'm aware of violence. And I think you could argue that guillotining someone is pretty darn violent, and that we have come a long way. You know, statistically speaking, it's a pretty peaceful time to be alive.
It absolutely is. And in fact, several years ago, I had Steven Pinker on the show, where his book, The Better Angels of Nature, argues that we are in the safest time of all. And that was controversial, but very, very interesting. But I want to use the example of the guillotine. The reason why they used the guillotine against royalty was it was quicker and less painful than drawing and quartering someone, than hanging someone. And so the guillotine is actually an improvement. If you look at – I love talking about this with my students. If you look at the Hammurabi's code, an eye for an eye, which feels really brutal to us. If you look at especially the Hebrew scriptures, you'll see this is a very violent book. A person is raped and their whole family is slaughtered in retaliation. A person is attacked and the village burns down the other village, right? Violence is constantly escalating. What an eye for an eye tells us is you can do no more damage than has been done to you. That escalating violence is impermissible and immoral. Now, there are certainly philosophical problems with the code that we could get into, but the point is sometimes what looks violent to us was actually a limiting moral rule, a way of making things better because it was so much worse. Wow. And so it's if you look at the grand scheme of history, you do see some levels of progress. One of the things that Pinker talks about is, yes, there is still human trafficking, but 150, 200 years ago, people were very, very open about human trafficking. That it was on a mass scale. People were proud of it. They sold people. They sold sex slaves. Now that sort of thing happens in secret and the authorities are after it. It doesn't mean the world is perfect. It doesn't mean the victims of human trafficking aren't traumatized and shouldn't be attended to, but it does mean on some level that things are getting better. And so the same thing might be said about war, in that the goal is to make it less brutal, less awful, eventually eradicating it in the end, just like we would eventually want to eradicate human trafficking.
We've been talking mostly about war when we talk about peace, but Kathy Kelly has also spent a lot of time, well, in prison, but also writing about prison reform. How does that relate to peace?
A huge portion of our population is in prison. In fact, I think we have the largest percentage of our population in prison in the world. Don't quote me on that, but it's something close to that. The people who live in prison are in a state of constant threat and violence and hostility. Our prison system is brutal, to say the least. It's not about rehabilitating anyone. It's just about punishing them and separating them. And people are often in prison because their communities are targeted, or because they were born into situations in which they had no other choice but to do things that put them against the law. And what Kathy's experiences in prison show is that these people who are in prison are humans too, and that they have internal lives, and that there can be beauty and relationships. And she tells an incredible story about the way that women in the federal prison that she was in were reacting to the Abu Ghraib photos that came out during the Iraq War. She was really concerned that a lot of these women had their sons and their partners in the military. And so she thought, well, maybe I'll keep my politics to myself. But when they saw what was happening in Abu Ghraib, they were horrified. As Americans, they started a prayer circle that grew and grew and grew. So that at the end, something like 80 people every morning at sunrise and then at sunset were praying for this country to be a better country, to fight its war better and more humanely. Now, that's not an image we get of prisoners, and that's not an image we get of what the internal life or the moral life of a quote-unquote criminal is. And so by going into prisons and by talking about the humanity and by bringing empathy into the equation, we get to then rethink our mechanism of incarceration and ask, well, people who are capable of doing this and people who are wanting to do this, is our prison system the best way to give them a full life in which they can be healthy and contribute to the community? Because again, if you compare our prisons to, say, the Scandinavian ones, those are built for rehabilitation. Those are built to recognize people's humanity and their rights and their dignity. And I think that's a really important word here. American prisons have no sense of dignity whatsoever. And if you ask some Americans, what you'd say is we shouldn't treat them dignified because they've lost that right by doing whatever they did. But the idea of human dignity is that it's inalienable, and a peace activist is going to recognize dignity in all of its forms, in all of its circumstances, even when the people who are dignified or who deserve that dignity aren't necessarily our vision of what the best human being should be.
Well, that's a fascinating conversation, and you can hear it this Sunday at 4 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Central. And it is on Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life with host Jack Russell Weinstein. Jack, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley.
Natural North Dakota is next.
Support for PrayPublic is provided by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's lifelong learning community. Information about classes and events at humanitiesnd.org.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, a rebroadcast from September 2017 on the peaceful transition of power.
A fascinating subject. You know, we are so used to having the power transfer in a peaceful way. Think of Richard Nixon resigning, turning over the tapes after the Supreme Court unanimously said that he must. This country has a long, stable tradition of peaceful transfer of power. And the question is, what was it like in Jefferson's time, and where are we headed today?
Yes, a listener asked us to have this conversation with Mr. Jefferson, and we did. And I think sometimes we do take that peaceful transition of power for granted.
Yes, we should not take it for granted. The stability that the United States has shown from 1788 until today is more fragile than we think.
Join us for that discussion and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And lately we have been airing essays from Tom Ezern as he reflects on Clay Jenkinson's book, The Language of Cottonwoods. But today we're going to take a little bit different approach. We are going to have one from biologist Chuck Lura, who actually does speak a little bit of the language of cottonwoods, in this week's Natural North Dakota essay, Cottonwood Gall.
There are a lot of cottonwood tree leaves lying in an area on the Lake Mittagoche hiking and biking trail. All of them are green, with a large round growth or gall on the leaf stalk or petiole. It made me wonder what was going on, so I had to do a little investigating. Galls can form in several plant parts, such as stems and leaves. The massive plant cells forming the gall are in response to a mite, insect, or pathogen in an attempt to isolate it from the rest of the plant. Gall formation is often initiated when an insect oviposits an egg or eggs inside the tissue of a host plant. The female injects some chemical or chemicals into the plant which stimulates gall formation, and when the larvae develops, it may also continue to produce the substances. The gall itself is composed of plant tissue, but the insect apparently controls the form because the characteristics of the gall are unique to the insect species. The chemistry of all of this, however, is not well documented. What I've been seeing is the work of aphids that form what is known as the cottonwood petiole gall. The aphids release a chemical that causes the formation of a blister-like structure around them that serves as a sort of a covering. At any rate, it apparently works quite well for the aphids and does little damage to the host cottonwood. The leaf drop might be a nuisance for us, but that's about it. If you spend some time outdoors, no doubt you'll see galls, perhaps on goldenrods, willows, roses, maples, oaks, as well as a variety of other plants. And if you happen to see lots of cottonwood leaves lying on the ground, take a closer look at them. Odds are that you'll see a gall on each one, perhaps a half inch or so in diameter on the leaf stalk. That's the cottonwood petiole gall. And although it may appear like the cottonwood tree is in big trouble, it's nothing to get worried about. I've put a couple pictures of the cottonwood leaves with the petiole galls along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
There is a word that I don't understand, and I'll just go right to it. It is the word bummed or bummer or bummed out.
Well, I'm now 68 years old, so I've been around a while, but I hadn't heard this one. Not my circus. Not my monkeys.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
Oh, man, that was stinky cheese.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Still to come on Main Street, Madeline reviews The Green Knight, and we have our discussion with Dave Thompson. But now, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. This week's U.S. Drought Monitor map shows conditions deteriorated in several areas where there was little or no rainfall, specifically in the northern plains from eastern Montana through western Minnesota. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Minnesota Department of Agriculture Commissioner Tom Peterson hosted a virtual roundtable with farmers from across the state to discuss the impact of ongoing severe drought conditions.
This is not about a brown yard for folks. This is about an economic disaster in many cases that needs to be addressed.
Walz says livestock producers are really hurting for forage. He told producers that federal help is on the way. Details are still being worked out, but Wall says it looks like Minnesota will be getting about $17 million. A drone from the Grand Forks Air Force Base crashed in a field near Gilby, North Dakota this morning. Air Force officials say the unmanned RQ-4 Block 40 Global Hawk was returning to the base when it crashed around 7 a.m. No injuries were reported. A fire that happened after the crash was extinguished. A recovery operation is also underway. The public is asked to avoid the area since it is now the site of an active military investigation. And Fargo-based Butler Machinery is expanding. The company, which sells construction and agriculture equipment, has purchased existing buildings in Watertown, South Dakota, and Sidney, Montana, and is building new in Kearney, Nebraska. That brings Butler's locations to 20. The Watertown and Kearney locations will be carrying Butler's full line, while the Sidney location will carry agriculture lines. Butler CEO Twyla Blotsky says at a time when other companies are retrenching, Butler is expanding, even in areas that are experiencing drought. Blotsky said the investment in ag equipment show a long-term commitment.
We're always going to grow food. I mean, no matter what we're doing and how everything else is working, fields will get planted and they will get harvested. And so as we look at this, it's I think it's time as great as ever. That egg market looks strong going into the future.
Blotsky says she's also excited that Congress is considering major infrastructure spending.
There's a lot of infrastructure needs in the United States, and I hope that they look at the needs of that and vote a bill in and support dollars that will definitely keep our contractors busy and replace a lot of aging infrastructure.
Butler currently employs around 840 people. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Mo Events presents the second annual A Taste of Culture, August 7th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Dickinson State University's Pavilion and Lawn. Exploring the various cultures represented throughout Western North Dakota, this event features a wide variety of ethnic food vendors, artists, and shops, as well as cultural entertainment throughout the day and activities for the kids. A Taste of Culture, August 7th in Dickinson. More information can be found online at the Mo Events Facebook page.
When you hear the old teletype machine, that means it is time for our weekly news discussion here on Main Street. Joining me from our Bismarck studio is news director Dave Thompson. Dave, thanks as always.
You're very welcome, Ashley.
We are ending the week with a couple of big stories here. Yes. We've got a drone crash to talk about and a big fine. The company Summit Midstream Partners fined $35 million for an oil spill going back to, I think, was it 2014?
Yes, yes. Now we're talking about a spill that actually is of the produced water that comes from oil. But
okay.
Oil was in the water itself. So, yes, it's probably the largest spill North Dakota's ever seen. And it also is the largest probably produced water spill on land that we've seen in the United States. So it's a big deal.
And the problem with these produced water spills is they have things like arsenic and benzene.
Correct,
and,
yes.
Yeah. So has there been a longer-term study on the impacts of the land?
That's I think, is underway right now. So, you know, this is the $35 million fine, which is huge, because we haven't seen a fine that large against any kind of midstream company or oil company in North Dakota. But there is proof from earlier spills that if you get salt, you know, the brine mm-hmm. and things like that, then land becomes unproductive for a number of years. So might have yeah. to take some stuff out of production. I think the real concern about this one, though, is that it emptied into a creek that actually was a tributary of the Missouri. Didn't quite get to the Missouri. But
okay. So
polluting
land and water sources,
yes,
then.
Exactly.
So is the $35 million, does that go to the people who were charged with cleaning up? Does it go to the landowners whose land was impacted? Some combination of each, I would
I think
assume.
It's going to be kind of some combination of each. But this is a $35 million. It also is a criminal offense. And I need to get into that just a little bit because the EPA determined that the owners of the pipeline were withholding information, which is a criminal offense. So that's part of it, too. The pipeline to their credit now, they've owned up to it and said, yeah, we weren't totally forthcoming on it. So now everything is pretty much transparent.
Mm. And if I recall correctly, the impact of the spill turned out to be some 10 times larger than the original reports came out.
That's right. And, I've got to give credit to Amy Sisk of the Bismarck Tribune, mm-hmm. who really has ferreted this story out. The Tribune partners with our news department, too. We cooperate and collaborate on some stories. So this was her story, and I just hats off to her for being dogged in it. She followed it from the beginning.
You said $35 million is a huge settlement. Do we know what is the second biggest fine?
I do not at this point, but okay. I do know that the one big spill we talked about was the one that was in eastern Williams County. It was a pipeline that went to the refinery in Mandan. There was a spill there, and that was a big spill, and that had to be cleaned up too.
Well, as we just heard in the newscast, there was a drone crash, a Global Hawk. Now, this is not one of those little ones that you see flying around at the beach.
No, we're talking about an unmanned, really fairly large aircraft. And it went down about 7 o'clock this morning, and they've got the scene cordoned off, and they're going to be doing some investigation as to why the Global Hawk crashed.
And this came out of the Air Force base?
Yeah,
it's a
Grand
military
Forks
operation, right?
Yes. It was a Grand Forks Air Force Base drone. And where the operation was taking place, we don't know yet because a lot of that's being kept under wraps until the investigation is complete.
Right. I imagine it's going to be an active scene for a while now.
And you are talking about these drones. These drones are pretty large, and they also cost a few billion.
Yeah,
I was
going to ask, do we know what these cost?
I do not offhand, and I was trying to look it up before we came on, but some of that stuff is also proprietary.
Hmm. All right. We do have some road conditions to talk about. I guess these ones are improvements along U.S. Highway 52. This is happening between Minot and Carrington. They're going to be adding passing lanes.
Right. Have you been on the roads that have passing lanes now?
Yeah, I have.
I have too. And they're so convenient because if you've got a lot of truck traffic, it makes it easier to pass those trucks. And that's why they did it. That's why I think they call it Super 2, is that that's the term they use for designation of those highways, where they do have those mile or 2 mile long passing lanes to allow you to get around some of the slower traffic.
So our producer, Skip Wood, just Googled the Global Hawk and sent me a note that they're around $220 million.
Those are, that's expensive
for
planes.
For those drones. Wow. That was, I can hardly fathom numbers like that. On these road things, it's one every 10 miles or so. How much of this is just because of population growth, or is it more so just in relation to the size of the vehicles, that kind of thing, like when you have a lot of oil or ag sorts of equipment, you just need better roads?
Right, and I think it's all of the above. We have more vehicles. We have more population. We have a lot more both agriculture and tanker vehicles on the roadways. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to get to a point where, and it's probably an interim point on these things because there's been some talk about doing a 4-lane on 52 from Minot to Carrington. I think that might be in the future yet.
What kind of population do you need for a 4-lane highway?
It's not so much population, it's about traffic counts.
Okay.
And if you've got a lot of truck traffic there, they're concerned. Of course, if you're going from Fargo, say, to Minot, a lot of people do that. They go into Jamestown and get on 52 mm-hmm. north to Carrington up to Minot. And to make that a 4-lane road will probably be a nice way to enhance commerce between Minot and Fargo.
Okay. And right now this is supposed to be phased in over 3 years.
That's correct, yes.
How's the drought looking across the state?
It's not looking very good.
No.
Todd McDonald had a report on there seems to be some pockets where there's some decent crops, but most of the state is in a drought situation. And some producers I've talked to said it rivals the late 80s in the drought that we lived through then.
Right. And in the late 80s, that was a lot of stress on food producers. And if I recall correctly, there were a number of farm-related suicides.
Yes, and that has been a concern for a while. You talk to groups like the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union. They're concerned about, you know, farming being a stressful industry anyway, because you're at the mercy of weather and prices. The good news, if there is some good news out of this, prices are pretty robust again, but you have to have crop to sell.
Yeah. Well, the combination of the hot, dry air and then the smoke coming in from Canada and from the West, air quality concerns. I know I've had a little tickle in my throat for about 10 days before I finally went, oh, yeah, it's because of the smoke.
Right. And a lot of this is coming from Canada. They're The report out of Manitoba, there are 154 separate fires in Manitoba right now. And, you know, that's a little tough to control, but it's pouring a lot of smoke into North Dakota and Minnesota.
Well, and I recently came back from Medora. I was there last weekend, and it was pretty remarkable. It was not that bad out in Medora or even Bismarck, but then as you continued east, and it was almost Valley City, a visible wall of smoke almost.
Right, and I remember that too.
Yeah.
And that's what the National Weather Service has said. It's been basically really in eastern North Dakota.
Yeah.
A lot of this is coming down.
There is a wind power company that has to remove some of their infrastructure here.
Yeah, they have to remove one of the turbine towers because, and this is a little complicated story. There was a farmstead, a homestead there, that the company determined was not occupied. Well, the owners said it was occupied at least on a part-time basis, and they said we kept the grass down, fields clean, and some of their kids were using it as temporary housing. Now, they built the turbine 1,100 feet from that residence when the setback was supposed to be 1,400 feet.
Yeah.
So now, after really some time, it's been over a year, the Public Service Commission has determined that the power company now has to take that turbine down.
Do we know how much that'll cost?
We are no. It's going to be in the six figures. That's what we know, and maybe in the seven figures.
Oh, wow. But those setbacks, of course, because there are people in these homes. Now, I read in that story, and I was a little bit surprised to learn, it's up to the company to determine if the house is occupied or not.
That's what the state law says, that it's the company's decision. Or the company's determination, because the company is going to take the fall if they determine it wrong, as you saw. Also, they're trying to get the setbacks right.
Okay. Yeah, and off by 300 feet, that's a pretty good chunk of space there.
Well, if you're talking about shadow flicker and also the noise of the turbines, you know, the decibels, that does make a difference.
There are a couple of departments merging in the state here, the Health Department and the Human Services Department. This is starting basically in September, and then they have about a year to really finish this. Is that right?
That is correct. And matter of fact, they've already started having discussions, having employee town hall meetings to determine what's going to happen next. They're going to be hiring consultants to make sure everything is copacetic between the two agencies. The issue here is that the Health Department is quite a bit smaller than the Human Services Department. The Human Services said 2,200 people. The Health Department just over 200.
Right, so
but there
times.
Are some things that seem to overlap in terms of responsibilities, for example, like childcare. There's some health issues. There's also some human service issues. So the idea is to try to blend these together into one department. What I find very interesting is that the way the legislation was written, there will be a superintendent of the department, and the health officer position is going to stay in, and that will be a physician.
So does that mean they're kind of co-leads, or will the state health officer report to the executive director of what will soon be the Department of Health and Human Services?
I think that's the way it's going to end up, but I don't think it's completely clear what the lines of authority are yet.
Okay. I'm wondering, when you say bring in consultants, and that kind of thing is always very expensive, a lot of places already have a Department of Health and Human Services, including the federal government. That's how we run it. Aren't there a lot of models that they could be looking to?
Yes, there are models they can be looking to, but you know, in terms of the unique things about North Dakota and these shared priorities are something that probably was delineated many, many years ago in the other states and the federal government. And so the state has to kind of look at the whole picture and make sure that, you know, everything is copacetic, the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, that type of thing.
Now, the whole point of this is to eliminate some redundancy, but often in the case of mergers, jobs get eliminated. They say that it's not meant to eliminate jobs, but is there anything written that is protection as we're not firing people?
The way I understand it, no. Okay. And I think that might be up for consultants and whatever final plans they come up with, that will probably steer the ship in terms of, you know, employee numbers, that type of thing.
Okay. Just about 30 seconds left here. The hospital superintendent, the state hospital superintendent, wants a new hospital, says the old ones are just past the point of fixing, it sounds like.
That is correct. They're going to be tearing down three of the buildings in the old state hospital grounds. They want to consolidate in a new, more modern building because a lot of these hospital buildings were built at the turn of the 20th century.
Oh, wow.
You know, 1890s, right. 1910s.
Medical care's changed a little bit since then.
Yes, it has.
All right. We check in with News Director Dave Thompson. Thanks.
Thank you.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
Dark Side of the Moon started in a rehearsal room. We did some jamming, writing.
Let's play E minor and A for an hour. That'll take up 5 minutes.
We were doing a lot of things with tape loops.
It was a very creative time.
We've really done something fantastic here.
Watch classic albums, Pink Floyd, The Dark Side of the Moon, tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
When you hear the fanfare, you know it is time for another movie review with our in-house movie critic, Matt Olien. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Of course, Ashley.
And you have gone to see the latest in a number of films that have some sort of King Arthur connection. And there are, I don't know, hundreds of adaptations of this between film and play at this point. The Green Knight.
Love this. It's at the Fargo Theater. It's at theaters all over the state right now in the region, so please check your listings. And I would call this an art house film disguised as a summer adventure action film. There is action and adventure in it, but it feels more artsy than that. It's very obscure. It's very obtuse. The script is a little hard to follow as we follow Sir Gawain, who is the nephew of King Arthur, played by Dev Patel, who's becoming a real superstar.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Personal History of David Copperfield was my favorite film of 2020. A lot of people did not see it. Please go see that movie. He's phenomenal in that movie. He plays Gawain, and this is based on a 14th century Welsh story, anonymously written, about Gawain and the Green Knight. And this year-long game that Gawain takes, he takes a quest to play this game, which could have dire consequences, with the Green Knight, this horrible-looking knight that comes and wants this challenge. And so he has to go find the Green Knight within a year after he meets him. And on this quest, I would say the film feels like a kind of strange mashup of Monty Python and the Holy Grail meets Apocalypse Now meets Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal.
Okay.
That's a lot to chew
on right
there.
At least Monty Python is a parody of King Arthur.
This is a very serious film. It's dark. The lighting is dark. The music score by Daniel Hart is wonderful as he kind of has this great music score of kind of old folk tunes he weaves in with kind of modern music. The cinematography by Andrew Draws Palermo is great, especially when the film gets outside and away from the castle walls. It has a really interesting look that I liked a lot. The plot is a little obtuse sometimes. Characters pop up. You're like, who are they? Joel Edgerton and Alicia Vikander both pop up in the film. They are pretty big stars. I think that the obtuse plotting might keep some mainstream audiences away. But if you go and kind of savor the visuals and the quest that he's on, kind of this Apocalypse Now, Holy Grail quest that he's on, It's the most visually dazzling film of the year, and I give David Lowery credit, the director. This was supposed to premiere last year at South by Southwest, another, shall we say, COVID-affected film. Mm-hmm. And now we're getting it, and it made $7 million over the weekend. That's very good for the amount of theaters it was in. So I recommend this one a lot. Just try to figure things out. But I eventually did figure out what was going on.
Okay. So it sounds like, despite the fact that it's a quest film and there's sword fighting and axes and all these things, it's as much appealing to people who want the visuals, who want this sort of deep storyline and maybe not even all that hardcore action.
That's what I would say, Ashley. Okay. It feels more of like an art house
film. The trailer, really, I watched it, was 2.5, and it was slow.
Yeah, and the film moves slowly as well, but I never got bored watching it.
Okay.
And Dev Patel, let me just say, when the camera is on him and there's a lot of close-ups, he doesn't have a lot of dialogue, but he is a movie star. He mm-hmm. really is. I mean, if Slumdog Millionaire didn't prove it, then he did with Lion, which was his Oscar nomination, and then David Copperfield, and now this. And he mm-hmm. is becoming this huge film star who can play a variety of roles. He's really got an expressive face. He's an interesting actor when he talks. I really like him a lot. Alicia Vikander is really good in this as well. Oscar winner, of course, phenomenal actress. But you're right. I would say it's the audience score on Rotten Tomatoes right now versus the critic score. And we find this sometimes, Ashley.
Yeah.
The critics seem to like it a little bit better than the audiences. So I think some audience members have come out going, that wasn't what I thought it was going
that
to be.
Weird.
So my caution to you going to this film, listeners, is be open-minded about it. It's not going to be Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It might not even be Excalibur. It's something on its own. And even though it has a lot of homages to a lot of films that I just mentioned, including Last Temptation of Christ, there's a sequence in this film that reminds me very much of a sequence that Scorsese did in Last Temptation of Christ. But even mm-hmm. though it's an homage to a lot of films, it feels like its own film that I haven't seen before.
Okay. Is it the normal storyline, like Lancelot and Guinevere and all those characters that are quite famous, or is this kind of an offshoot, you know, like all these Marvel films and sometimes it's a lesser-known character?
Great point. I think this – I would call this an offshoot. Lancelot's
okay.
not in it. Arthur and Guinevere are in it briefly.
Okay.
But we don't see Lancelot, Galahad, you know, all these other knights of the Round Table. We do see the Round Table early in the film when Gawain accepts the quest to battle the Green Knight, and no one else raises their hand. So we do see the knights. They're just not identified.
Okay. Well, like I mentioned at the beginning, there are hundreds of novels, plays, movies, comic books, video games that are all featuring some sort of King Arthur legend. Which film stars the only actress to get the triple crown of acting in both the U.S. and the United Kingdom? In fact, the only person to have ever done this.
Is it Helen Mirren?
It is. And which film is
Excalibur.
That?
Excalibur.
There you go. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Hardy Kondabulu weighed in on the new name for the Cleveland baseball team.
The thing with the Guardians, it's only one step better than the Cleveland foster parents.
I'm Peter Sagal. We'll be sharing those observations with a live audience. Remember those? In Philadelphia. So join us for this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 6th. Before a vaccine, polio created a fear for Americans that was second only to the atomic bomb. Polio could paralyze and even kill, and little could be done for patients. The mysterious illness struck especially hard in summertime, and the extent of the outbreaks varied. Children were the most susceptible. Crutches, leg braces, wheelchairs, and dreaded iron lungs were the images of polio. Iron lungs were massive breathing machines that entombed a person's body below the neck. The March of Dimes appealed to the American public for donations for research and patient care. One popular fundraiser for years was the annual calf auction in Mandan, begun in 1953, sponsored by Kist Livestock, and broadcast on the radio. Bids were in person or by telephone from throughout North Dakota and even from other states. Bidders bought, sold, and resold a donated calf as many as 1,800 times until the bidding ended. The auction could last hours, 1 year netting over $15,000. The calf would go to a polio-stricken child. The event involved the governor, who in years past presented the calf or drew the name of the child who would receive it. In 1952, the U.S. faced its worst polio outbreak. Nearly 300 North Dakotans were stricken that year, and 12 died. On this date that year, the Burley County Red Cross announced a call for nurses to volunteer in polio-hit areas of Illinois and Texas. The plea came days after a similar call in Fargo. The Red Cross would provide transportation and living costs for nurses who responded. Also, that summer of 1952, a North Dakota Air National Guard pilot flew to Minneapolis to pick up a piece of essential medical equipment for a polio patient in an iron lung in the Fargo Veterans Hospital. The National Guard also flew a young woman home to Gladstone, North Dakota for Christmas from Ann Arbor, Michigan, where she had been in an iron lung for 8 months. Most of the time, she still needed a chest respirator to help her breathe. In 1953, a new treatment from human plasma had the state health department hoping it would prove effective, but the real knockout against the virus was almost in sight, a vaccine. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Udo Kier has been acting in all kinds of films for decades, except when he's not.
I try not to act, and I don't sing in the role of Pat that I was acting in the film.
At the age of 76, he has his first starring role in Swan Song. Plus the price of the Olympics to Japan, great beach reads and sports, those stories and all the news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, how much do you really know about the journey that General Custer made on his way to the Battle of Little Bighorn? We're going to learn about it in the new book, A Field Guide to Custer's Camps, On the March to the Little Bighorn. That's Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.